Chapter 9, London, 20 Years After. In recent years, people have sometimes asked how long it took me to adjust to living in England after my 20 years in the East. In fact, it took me no time at all. I might even say that the idea that one needs time to adjust to a new situation or set of circumstances and has just to sit there adjusting for a few weeks or months before being able to do anything was meaningless to me, not to say absurd. There was not such a great deal of difference between arriving in London and taking up residence at the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara and arriving in Calcutta or Bombay or Pune and going to stay at one of the local monasteries with friends. Of course, this did not mean that there were not differences between London and the various Indian cities I was accustomed to visit. Obviously, the differences between them were enormous, but for me, there was no question of my having to make a psychological adjustment to those differences, as distinct from my familiarising myself with them and learning to take them into account when it was necessary to do so. There was no question of my being given an emotional shock by the new situation, and no question, therefore, of my needing time to recover from that shock. One of the biggest differences between London on the one hand and the Indian cities on the other was a singular one I had noticed on the very day of my arrival. Compared with Calcutta and Bombay and even Pune, London was a very quiet place. The traffic rolled smoothly through the streets, hardly making a sound, and it all kept miraculously to the side of the road to which it was supposed to keep. There were no bullock carts or wandering cows getting in the way or sweating coolies pushing barrows piled high with tins of kerosene or sacks of flour. What was hardly less strange, London was practically deserted. There were no streets aswarm with men, women and children, and the few people who were about behaved in an orderly fashion. No one walked in the road or squatted to urinate in the gutter. And there were no beggars. Compared with what I was used to when I left my mountain retreat to travel the plains of India, London was, quote, lux carum e volupte, as the lands to which Baudelaire, in a famous poem, invites his faithless beloved to accompany him. The one place that was neither lux nor carum nor volupte was Haverstock Hill, or at least that part of it, on which the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara happened to be situated. A busy arterial road, it was so noisy that one had a long way to go before finding a noisier. Traffic, especially lorries, roared and thundered up and down it incessantly, from early morning until late at night, or rather, until the early hours of the following day, so that one had only a few hours' respite from the din. Sometimes the traffic was so heavy, even on a Sunday afternoon, that the whole building shook with the vibrations and the windows rattled. On the opposite side of the road stood the Haverstock Arms, and on Friday and Saturday nights, especially, the shouts and cries of revellers could be heard above the noise of the traffic. In the whole of northwest London, there could hardly have been a less suitable spot for a Buddhist monastery. What, then, had led Ananda Bodhi and the Sangha Trust to fix on 131 Haverstock Hill as the new home of the English Sangha and the venue of its teaching activities? The reason was that Haverstock Hill, together with its continuation Roslyn Hill, ran straight through the then London borough of Hampstead, bisecting it along its north-south axis. And Hampstead was reputed to have more intellectuals to the square mile than any other part of the metropolis. As Buddhism was an intellectual religion and could therefore be expected to have a special appeal for Western intellectuals, what better location for a Vihara could there be than in the area where the potential interest was greatest? Western intellectuals who had no faith in meaningless rites and ceremonies and who relied solely on reason were already more than halfway to Buddhism. Let them only hear the Dharma in its pure Theravadin form from the lips of a Theravadin Buddhist monk, and they will be sure to embrace it immediately. I had long been familiar with this line of argument. It was a favourite one with Western-educated Eastern Buddhists like Narada Thera, the doyen of the English-speaking monks of Ceylon, who had visited Europe on more than one so-called mission of mercy, and who seemed to believe, judging by the reports he wrote, that inasmuch as the intellectual Westerners had listened attentively to his lectures and applauded politely at the end, he had made converts of them on the spot. No doubt there were a few who really did think of Buddhism as an early Indian form of rationalism, and to whom it appealed for that reason. No doubt they had their representatives within the British Buddhist movement and in London and elsewhere. But so far as I could make out, Western intellectuals in general were more likely to embrace scientific materialism and scepticism, or even cynicism and nihilism, than a spiritual, transcendentally oriented teaching such as Buddhism. Apart from Maurice Walsh, who was a minor academic rather than an intellectual, during my tenure as incumbent of the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara, I did not, to my knowledge, see even one of the famed Hampstead intellectuals at my Sunday afternoon lectures. They preferred to play chess at Prompt Corner in Southend Green. People have also sometimes asked me in recent years if I ever missed India, especially Kalimpong, the little town in the foothills of the eastern Himalayas where I had lived for 14 years and where I had several teachers and many friends. Did I not miss them particularly badly during those first few months after my return to England? So far as I remember, I did not miss them at all, if by missing one means pining for them and regretting that I was not there in India, especially in Kalimpong, instead of being where I actually was. This is certainly not to say that I never thought of them. I thought of India, and of Kalimpong in particular, every now and then, with great fondness. I thought of the crowded, colourful bazaars, of the green rice fields, of the great rivers, of the mighty snow-capped mountain ranges. I thought of my peaceful hillside hermitage, where in latter years I had been wont to spend the 3 or 4 months of the rains reading, writing, and meditating, and hearing no other sound than that of the rain drumming on the roof and the occasional soothing tinkle of the wind bells on the veranda outside my window. Above all, perhaps, I thought of, and sometimes found time to write to, my kind teachers, particularly Dado Rinpoche, and to my affectionate friends, of whom I had many in Calcutta, Bombay, Pune, Ahmedabad, Nagpur, Jalalpur, and Delhi, and other parts of the country. I have sometimes wondered why, after my return to England, I did not miss my Indian friends, at least to a small extent, especially as I was now having to live and work with people who, almost without exception, were perfect strangers to me. But unless memory plays me false, I did not miss them, did not, that is to say, pine for them or regret I was not in their company. In this connection, I recall what one of them once told me after I had spent some 3 weeks in Pune giving lectures for the benefit of my ex-untouchable Buddhist friends. "We have all become very fond of you," he said, "and we are extremely sorry to see you go. But you do not seem to be at all sorry to be leaving us." Whether these words expressed admiration for my detachment as a monk, or disappointment at my indifference as a friend, or even a mixture of both, I do not know. But they made an impression on me at the time, and gave me food for thought afterwards. Detachment, in the sense of freedom from self-interest, was one thing. Indifference, in the sense of a lack of concern for other people, quite another. While the former was perfectly compatible with true friendship, the latter made any kind of friendship impossible. Did my not feeling sorry to be leaving my friends in Pune and my not missing my Indian friends after my return to England mean that I was detached, or did it mean that I was indifferent? Was there, I even wondered, a general lack of emotion in my makeup? In the end, I came to the conclusion that I was neither without concern for other people nor lacking in emotion generally. But my feelings were to a great extent buried. They were buried beneath layers of reticence and reserve through which it was difficult for them to break. For this, they were, so far as I could see, a number of reasons. Besides my cultural conditioning as an Englishman, which had probably given me a stiff upper lip without my realising it, there was the fact that the natural expression of my feelings had been inhibited by my being obliged from an early age to be constantly aware of what I was doing. Then again, I was a Buddhist monk who was expected to be always calm and controlled, and at the time of my arrival at the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara, I had been a monk for 14 years, longer if my period as a freelance wandering ascetic is included. But there were other, more positive reasons for my apparent coldness. If my feelings strove to break through the layers of reticence and reserve less urgently than they might have done, it was partly because they had an alternative outlet. This outlet was poetry, which I had written since I was a boy, and in which I could express my feelings freely. Similarly, if I did not miss my Indian friends at all, my not missing them was partly due to the fact that I possessed a vivid imagination, so that whenever I thought of them, it was as though they were, in a manner of speaking, actually present, and I could see them. In other words, I did not miss them in the ordinary sense of the term, because they were not really absent, at least not when I was thinking of them. Not that I very often felt the need to think of them, and, as it were, enjoy their company. My life was a full one, and I was kept very busy, not infrequently until late at night and even into the early hours. I had the management of the Vihara to attend to, besides which there were lectures to prepare, provincial Buddhist groups to visit, people to see, and my immediate environs to explore. During my first few weeks in England, explorations were limited to the Belsize bookshop and the nearer reaches of Hampstead Heath. But later I re-familiarised myself with central London, which I had known very well during the war, visiting the second-hand bookshops in Charing Cross Road again, renewing my acquaintance with the Egyptian mummies in the British Museum, and once more walking past County Hall, where I had worked for 2 years before being conscripted. As I made my way around, I realised that London was not only different in so many ways from the major conurbations of India, but is also different from its own former wartime self. Red double-deckers still plied the major London routes, but the bone-shaking trams and swift, silent trolley buses had gone, and there were more motor cars on the roads. Laundrettes and Indian restaurants had sprung up and become, apparently, an integral part of people's lives. TV aerials sprouted from rooftops, and men no longer raised their hats when passing the cenotaph in Whitehall. I also noticed that people were much better dressed and had, as it seemed, more money to spend. There were certainly more consumer goods in the shops for them to buy. So that I could not but recall the ignoble slogan, "You've never had it so good," with which Harold Macmillan and the Conservative Party were said to have won a general election, and which, when the echo of it reached me in distant Kalimpong, had almost made me ashamed of being British. But though much had changed, much had remained unchanged. Besides the red double-deckers, red telephone kiosks and red pillar boxes were still to be seen. Policemen wore the same kind of helmets as before. The underground was as stuffy, crowded and convenient as ever. And in the city there were still a few bomb sites, grim reminders of the Blitz, from whose rubble heaps there rose clumps of pink flowering willow herb.